This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. We all rely on the sun to survive. It's a pretty big deal to us, Earthlings. But in the big picture, the sun is just one of hundreds of billions of stars in the Milky Way galaxy. And while the Milky Way is an awesome place to live, I mean, it is, right? It too is just one of hundreds of billions of galaxies in the universe. Are you feeling small yet? I am. There's lots of stuff in the cosmos bigger than us. And now researchers have discovered the biggest thing so far, a glob of galaxies that's 4 billion light years wide. That's like stacking 40,000 Milky Ways end to end. There's just one problem with this colossal formation. According to cosmologist calculations, it's not supposed to exist. It's too big. Of course, the universe doesn't play by our rules, so what do we make of this? Could the universe be a little stranger than we thought? Always, right? My guests are here to talk about that and other astronomy discoveries for the rest of the hour. Ron Cowan is a freelance astronomy and physics reporter based in Silver Spring, Maryland. You can read his stories at roncowan.com. He joins us from NPR in Washington. Welcome back to Science Friday, Ron.
Thanks a lot.
Gerald Villiger is an associate professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Louisville in Kentucky. He joins us from Louisville Public Radio. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Villiger.
Thanks for inviting me on.
Let's start with you, Dr. Villiger. Tell us a little bit more about this clump of galaxies. What was it exactly? What is it?
It's a large quasar group. And that begs the question, what's a quasar? Quasar is actually a piece of a galaxy. It's the core of a galaxy which is very, very bright. It outshines the rest of the galaxy by a lot. So it would be like having, if you have a galaxy which is, say, a bunch of houses in a housing development, the quasar is a skyscraper. So it completely outshines, in terms of light, the stuff around it. And if you look at it from far away, it looks like a little point. Now, these quasars are very rare phenomena. They might be only a fraction of a percent of all galaxies would have one of these bright quasars in them at any one time. They're also a transient phenomenon. So imagine you have a skyscraper, and then it has a light to warn airplanes, but it's only on for a little bit of the time. So what we found is basically a long string of these quasars. They're galaxies. They probably have other galaxies around them. They're faint. We don't see them yet because we have to stare for a long time. And we see this long string of these rare objects, which are only bright for a short time, and they're statistically different from the other quasars around in the sky. So it's like finding an archipelago of islands all together, but these islands are constantly bobbing up and down under the waves, or all the skyscrapers are turning on their lights at the same time. And we don't know whether that means that there are a lot of galaxies around there, which, well, there's some indirect evidence that there may be, or they all happen to be turning on their lights at the same time. Whichever the reason, it's a bigger cohesive unit than we think should exist based on our best models of the universe so far.
Gerard Villiger, so tell us about how it breaks the theory. Wasn't this related to something that Einstein put forward for his theory of relativity, that the universe is more uniform than this?
Well, what Einstein did, he postulated something called the cosmological principle, which says that if you look on a big enough scale, one part of the universe should be pretty much another part of the universe. And that makes it possible for us to take a sample, look at a piece of the sky, and say, okay, we're going to learn about the rest of the universe. As long as you look in a big enough piece of sky, you're fine. It's like if you're looking at a map of, if you're looking at the Earth, if you're looking, say, the United States from space, and you want to know what's in the country, you're looking with your satellite. If you have a little camera with a little field of view, and you have, say, a 10-mile swath, then you can only catch maybe a cornfield or maybe a city or maybe Manhattan. But you have to look at enough of that to make a generalization about the U.S. For the same reason, you have to look at a big enough piece of space to understand the universe as a whole. And that underpins a lot of the way our calculations and the way we look at the universe. So looking at pieces of the sky is actually pretty expensive in terms of telescope time. You have to take a telescope and you have to look and look and look and look. The sky is big. We can't survey the sky, the whole sky, to the kind of detail we want. So we pick a little piece, and we study it. Fine. And we've made a large number of surveys of various sensitivities in various areas. And occasionally we look all over the sky. So in terms of the size of this group of quasars compared to the size of the universe, it takes up a volume which is something like 2%, 1/40th, 1/50th of the universe. That's actually really, really big. And so if we want to have a good idea of what the universe is like in general, if this is a cohesive unit, which is the kind of size of something that you have to probe to get a good idea of the universe, then we have to make our surveys bigger.
Ron, what do you make of this study?
Well, I guess one question I have is, was there enough time since the universe formed for such a large structure to come into being? I mean, is there enough time for that?
Jerry?
Aha. That's actually the key. Although this is a big discovery, we have to go into the details. And there are several ways of looking at what's an object. Okay, you look at our solar system. It's a cohesive unit. You have the planets going around the sun. It's held together by gravity. You have our galaxy. That's actually also a cohesive unit. You have the stars that are held together by their gravity, and they're spinning around the center. That's fine. We actually live in a group of galaxies, and that's a cohesive unit, too. It's called a local group, and they're bound together by their gravity. Now, when you talk about clusters of galaxies, those also are bound together by their gravity. But beyond that, there are things called superclusters. Clusters of galaxies tend to be blobby. Superclusters tend to have some complicated structure, snaky, maybe like a skeleton, something like that. They're not round blobs, and they're also less and less and less held together by their own gravity. Now, this large quasar group is big enough, it would be very difficult to accept it being held together by its own gravity. What it could be is a signature of a primordial density fluctuation. When the universe was young, after the Big Bang, there were little regions of the universe that were slightly denser than other regions. And these grow because gravity is a one-way force. You fall in. But it does take time for assemblies of objects to come together by gravity. This large quasar group is bigger than that scale. So it didn't pull itself together by gravity. It's just there. Now, is it there because there was a big, dense spot in the universe when it was young? Or do we see this because all the quasars happen to turn on at the same time, and otherwise it's not a lot of extra matter there?
Yet to be determined, I take it.
Mm-hmm. Maybe they are making a giant Christmas celebration. They're putting up strobe lights in all the skyscrapers.
Ron, you were at the meeting of the American Astronomical Society last week in California, and you reported on a fascinating story about an old-timer, the oldest star we've ever discovered. Is that right?
Right. It's sort of the Methuselah of stars, and it's at least 13.2 billion years. I mean, the way they age it is, they say it's 13.9 billion years, give or take 700 million, and that may sound like a somewhat imprecise number, but it's the most precise number so far. And the thing is that the universe itself, we believe from other data, is 13.7 billion years. So this star formed really early. And what's interesting is as old as it is, it is not the first generation of stars to have formed. It's got to be in the second. And the reason we know that is that the first generation of stars formed from the stuff that was forged in the Big Bang, which was mostly hydrogen and helium. This star contains some known elements that are heavier than helium, and those would have had to have been forged within the first generation of stars. So it's a second generation star, despite the fact that it's 13.2 billion years. And that means the first generation, not only did it have to, we already believed that it lived and died quickly, but that there was some kind of lag, delay between the first generation and the second. But there wasn't much. The delay was very short. That second generation came into being very, very quickly.
Is aging stars, does that come down to just looking at what they're made of?
There's a couple of ways to do it. People knew for a couple of decades this particular star was elderly because I'll call it trace amounts of elements heavier than helium. But the way these guys did it is they used some star trackers on the Hubble Space Telescope to get a really precise distance for this star, found out that it was 190 light years from the solar system, which is actually really essentially in our backyard. And from there, they could get the true brightness of the star and feed it into models where, given the true brightness of the star and kind of the phase of where it is in its evolution, they could figure out exactly how old it was. But in this case, a key was getting its distance. And they looked over a period, I think, of between 2003 to 2011 with Hubble to get the distance with these star trackers.
What are the chances of finding one of those first-generation stars?
Right. I think we probably can't find it with an existing telescope, but the James Webb Space Telescope, which is Hubble's successor, which is supposed to be launched in 2018, it will look with its infrared eye, and it will have the ability to see, if not single first stars, certainly groups of the first stars. Look back far enough in time, 13.7 billion years, and actually have perhaps images of at least groups of these first stars.
Jerry Villiger, anything to add?
That's one of the main pushes, actually, for the James Webb Space Telescope. This very first generation of stars is actually, it's very interesting because the physics changes, the actual recipe for how do stars shine, how are they born, how do they shine, and how do they die. It's different because these trace elements, although not a very high percentage, these trace elements are very, very important because they add a lot of electrons into the mix, and electrons make things happen with photons. And so the whole mechanism of how these early stars formed is different from what we know. There are lots and lots of models. We would love to observe some of these so we can see whether the models are actually correct.
What are some of the... let me sneak in an ID, actually. I'm Flora Lichtman, and
sure.
This is Science Friday from NPR. So what are some of the ideas about how these stars might behave differently, these first-generation stars?
They could be very massive and very short-lived.
Right.
And actually, there's a big industry in astronomy. How do stars form? The exact mechanism, you have a cloud of gas, and then there's a little density clump inside of it, and then that starts to grow. Gravity's a one-way force. A galaxy forms from a little density clump pulling on things. A star, too, actually forms in a very much smaller scale. And so this, you have a collapse, and it happens on a certain time scale, and then you have an object in the middle which is getting denser and denser, and if you push on something, in general, you heat it up, so it heats up in a certain way at a certain speed, and then eventually you form some jets because there's material crashing in, but not all of it can go down the drain. It's like pouring a bucket of water down a bathtub drain, and the drain can only take so much water, and the rest of it splashes back. And then the star will ignite its nuclear fire. It'll turn hydrogen into helium in its core, and then eventually, if it's a big star, it explodes, and then it seeds the rest of the space around it with elements not only that it made during its life, but elements that were made in the explosion. Those are heavy elements. Now, how many of these heavy elements are made? That's the stuff for the next generation of stars.
Mm.
So we're looking at how the second generation of stars formed as well.
Ron, another story you reported was about the incredible number of planets in the Milky Way. New research into this. Tell us about it.
Right, and so this is it's looking at data from the Kepler space telescope, and Kepler finds planets in a pretty narrow patch of sky, and it's also pretty distant. And the way Kepler looks for planets is that if planets are aligned very well, they will pass in front of their parent star periodically as they orbit, as seen by Kepler, and there'll be a tiny, tiny amount of dimming, a mini eclipse, each time it passes in front. And that's how Kepler sees planets. And so researchers, for example, looked at stars, the number of planets around stars called M-dwarfs. M-dwarfs are less massive than the Sun. They're fainter, they're cooler. And the neat thing about M-dwarfs is that they account for 75% of all the stars in our galaxy. And people extrapolated from seeing how many planets there were around M-dwarfs in this narrow patch of sky that Kepler's seen. Basically, it's sort of like one planet per star, and because we think there's around 100 billion stars in our whole galaxy, therefore, there's about 100 billion planets. One thing that's interesting is that another group, Dave Charbonneau and Courtney Dressing of Harvard, took that a bit further. They wanted to find out the number of potentially habitable planets around M dwarfs. These are, what do I mean by potentially habitable? They're in a zone where water, liquid water, could exist on a rocky surface of a planet. And they calculate from the number of potentially habitable planets around M dwarfs, the Kepler seas, that there should be an Earth-sized potentially habitable planet within 20 light years of the solar system. So it would be, there'd be a planet just like home, now not orbiting a sun-like star, orbiting an M dwarf, but basically among the nearest stars in the Milky Way. And that 6% of that 100 billion number that I just talked about, 6% of them, which is still a very big number, are likely to have planets where liquid water could exist. And, I mean, the whole thing here is that it takes a full year for a habitable Earth-like planet to orbit a sun-like star because the Earth takes a year to form, to go around the sun. So Kepler doesn't know how many Earth-size habitable planets orbit sun-like stars, but they do with M dwarfs.
Wow, it's fascinating. Mm. Unfortunately, that flew by, but we have to leave it here. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Ron Cowan is a freelance astronomy and physics reporter based in Silver Spring, Maryland. You can read his stories at roncowan.com. And Gerard Villiger is an associate professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Louisville in Kentucky. Our program senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Our associate senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Luis Quevedo is our Spanish language producer. Denise Chow is our associate producer. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Neil Rausch is our technical director, and he's at the controls here in New York. Thanks, Neil. If you'd like to find us, check out our website, of course, sciencefriday.com, where you can find the videos, or on Twitter, at SciFry, and Facebook, too. We're everywhere. And you can breathe easy. The captain of Starship Science Friday, you know who I mean, Ira Flato, will be back next week. In New York, I'm Flora Lichtman.